We'll go ahead and call the order of this meeting of the planning commission, Tuesday, October 23rd, 2018, 7:02 PM. And we are at the Community Recreation Center. First item of business is public comment. I did not see anybody signing up for that. If anybody's here that would like to make a public comment, please feel free, you have 3 minutes.
Possibly Dan might want to comment on the hearing item.
We can have you guys as the applicant presentation.
Okay.
So I think you're fine.
Okay. We'll close that portion of the meeting and begin with the approval of minutes from the September 25th, 2018 Planning Commission meeting. Did you have an opportunity to read through those? Were there any comments?
You want to recognize your voting members?
Oh,
too?
Thank you. We will recognize these voting members tonight, all the attendants. Eric Schlesser.
Floor.
Eric Schlor, Marie Pratt, Jared Irwin, and Jared Anderson.
Only your alternates.
Wow, okay then. Thank you. So, any comments about the minutes from the week? Possibly, Chairman, if you could clarify.
Sure.
There was a statement. This is probably being granular, but there was a statement in the minutes concerning the conditional use process. And it was my understanding that the Planning Commission was the land use authority.
What is stated in that?
That it would be required proof of the city council.
It depends. In our case, cities can designate who the approval body is for a conditional use permit. In some cases, it's the city council. In some cases, it's the planning commission. In some cases, it's staff. So if you were going to apply for a fence, which is a conditional use, staff would be the conditional use authority on that. If you were going to apply for, I'm drawing a blank on what a planning commission one is. I do know. A fence adjacent to a trail, planning commission would be the land use authority on it. Conditional use for a use in the SC1 zone as a commercial use, the city council will be the land use authority on that. If you have questions on it, there's a table in 10.5.38 or 39. There's a conditional use section in that section of the code that outlines who the a body is that approves those conditional uses.
I just thought that might be necessary in cases that got in someone's hands that tried to make that into an issue.
I could see them doing that. I could see somebody doing that, but I also think that the code would supersede any minute there. So I think that's okay.
I have nothing else. I'll entertain a motion. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Great. All right, review and recommendation on amendments to Lakeshore Trail subdivision.
Okay. So Lakeshore Trails is a subdivision that's just south of the city building, just off of Canyon Road. The plat amendment tonight is I need to just kind of state up front, it's not changing any density, it's not granting any more building rights of any sort to the developers. It's simply incorporating a portion of their land into this subdivision as a non-buildable parcel. So, state code on this one, because most of the time these types of things require public hearings, which you notice on the agenda that there is not one tonight for this. State code on this one, I'm going to follow along. I'm in section 10-9A6608, and it says, this is part two, it says, unless a local ordinance provides otherwise, the public hearing requirement of subsection does not apply. This is under vacating, altering, or amending the subdivision plat. So we're saying, public hearing requirement of subsection 1C does not apply if the land use authority may consider at a public meeting in order to petition to vacate or amend subdivision plat if, and so there's conditions on this test. Petitioner seeks to join two or more of the petitioner fee owners contiguous lots, and that's what we're doing tonight. He's the petitioner fee owner for both of these lots, and they are contiguous. And so he actually meets, I think, all of those tests there, but that's why you don't see a public hearing tonight. We're not granting any density. It's simply incorporating portions of the land into the subdivision. Now, in a hypothetical sense, if let's say that they were to sell this, the person was to put up like a
tonight. Yeah, maybe just turn it down.
Great. If I'm talking too soft, let me know. Usually the people behind me can't hear, so I'll turn this way. How's that? So let's say that they sold it on your on the map here. You all have the map, right? It's hard to see, but parcel D in lot 21, we're discussing on merging those into one parcel, calling that lot 21, right? And then everything to the east, which is kind of outlined in red there, would be added as just non-buildable. It's not open space, it'd just be a parcel. We're going to call it E right now because it's that one's not used. But let's say that somebody bought parcel 21, the new parcel 21, and they bought parcel D. They put a home on lot 21, and let's say that 15 years down the road, they decide that they want to subdivide this parcel D. They could do it. It is not. It was not when they did their density calculations for their subdivision. Parcel E was not included in that. So let's say that that homeowner in 15 years wanted to subdivide that land. What they'd have to do is go through our subdivision process for the hillside zone. They'd have to do a slope analysis of that whole hillside and establish where the flat pieces are. And that, from doing that analysis, they'd be granted a certain amount of density. And then they'd have to put in the infrastructure leading up to that new subdivision. So that one is subdivided. The other ones are not.
So let me clarify. So 21 would not be subdivided?
No.
Okay.
So,
because right now it's shown as two lots.
Right now it's shown as two lots.
Each could be buildable.
No. Lot parcel E is subdivisible. The new portion they're bringing in is subdivisible. It's very difficult. I'm just to be frank. It's very difficult to subdivide this piece because the only way to get access to it would be from the end of Morgan.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to take it all the way through and connect it to another road because Morgan terminates at 1,000 feet. And our code does not allow for cul-de-sacs to be longer than 1,000 feet.
Right.
So it would have to no longer be a cul-de-sac. One of the topographical problems there is after Morgan was ripping up there where that fire was a month or two ago, there's a big ravine, some natural drainage and swell. And you'd have to get a road and utilities over that. Right now it's cost prohibitive.
Yeah.
Mike, Geddes, Ed Wilson, we spent a lot of time talking about that a few years ago. It's just, right now it's not feasible. Anyway. So what we're doing is we're looking at amending this portion of the map, this plat, to incorporate this portion of land that they own into the amended subdivision as the parcel and amending lot 29.
I got asked a question.
Sure.
Why?
Just to make it cleaner, and that we had never any intention of adding any density, and that area up there just makes if it's all one, it makes it more usable.
That, and we found out that according to the code, David Bunker originally told us we should do what we're doing now. He said we're going to save money by not doing it. We didn't realize at the time that. If the person bought 21 and bought the parcel as it stands now, can't even theoretically build a barn or put a fence up or anything. With this, they would be able to put a fence up or a barn. So, can't build a house.
Not a dwelling, but a structure.
Right.
All right. And as I'm reading this map, lot 21, not lot 21 plus D, but just lot 21, it has no frontage, right? There is, okay.
It's a shared driveway with lot
22. Okay.
Yeah, so it comes up at the end of Bay Hill.
Got it. Yeah. Just look.
The haul just really is so the person can have horses in a sense. We can sell it, so they can have horses back.
And what's that recommendation on this?
I don't have any issues.
But partially is going to be separate control.
Partially is going to be separate.
However, if a person purchased E with 21, since there is no road there.
Because the only way we can sell parcel E is with 21. We won't sell one without the other.
Right, because there's no access to it.
Well, that, I mean, Morgan, theory, Morgan continues to connect to Isaac's Hollow, but it'll never happen.
But it's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen.
Not in the near future.
Not in my lifetime, because there's a fault. There are all kinds of problems with that.
Yeah.
Really problematic. It's not to say that it won't happen, it's just, I think it's highly unlikely. But this doesn't preclude that from happening. This doesn't put any roadblocks up in that development. It should occur.
Questions? So when you were saying, Mike, more usable, you were talking as essentially an annex to watch on one.
The 21. Yeah, so partially you would be, so
21 just gets bigger.
Yep. Parcel E would be part of lot, not part of lot 21, but sold with a conventional lot 21. It makes it a horse property. If you've ever been up there, there's a nice flat spot up there it's a big flat spot too.
Perfect for work.
And if you could get utilities to it, it would make a nice spot for homes with you, but unfortunately, right now, that's not the case. But you could put up a barn or a corral or some sort.
But not a carport, because we don't cook there.
Yeah. By the time that is developed,
we'll
put
the market
out.
Okay.
Any
other comments?
Are there any reasons why we shouldn't do this?
It's a fair question. I can't think of any. I mean, really, when lot 21 gets developed, the real discussion that is going to be had between staff and whoever develops that lot is not going to be about parcel E. It's going to be about lot 21, about where the home is, how you access it, what type of fire protection it has. And that kind of concern, but that already is a concern. This making a decision on that one way or another is going to change that.
I'm willing to be honest in saying there is a negative, but it's offset by a positive that's generated at the same time. And that is, if you guys put a horse or a barn up there, obviously it creates human activity, more possibility of a fire occurring. But the fact that he's developing it and cleaning it and clearing it reduces the same time the fire.
We established a few meetings ago that this entire side of the valley is a fire hazard. So,
it's inevitable.
Eventually. Yeah. He will be the first one hit, whoever's up there. But he'll also have, he should be ready to protect himself.
So, I mean, I don't have any issues with the parcel E. Really, the concern, the discussions are going to take place around lot 21, and how you get utilities and service up to that point.
But lot 21 is already
It's already going to go.
But that was actually my final question, was parcel C and lot 22, did you want to merge those two lots?
Eric Sowell, he owns,
oh,
he owns, it's the same concept, yeah. He owns the parcel behind him.
Oh, okay.
He's using it for playground.
Right, and he did, I mean, if he wants to come and put a barn there, most of it's a not usable, typical.
Yeah.
But if you wanted to put a building, I suppose you'd have to come and do the same thing.
But it's already owned by someone else.
But it's owned by.
It's charred.
Well, yeah, it burns. In that parcel, that parcel, see a portion of that burned with that fire in July. He's got a nice lawn. I mean, he's kind of protected. He's actually done a really good job, I think.
Yeah, the concept, he's created a fire rating.
Yeah.
His problem.
Yeah. The native stuff around it did burn.
Yeah.
Yes, this will go on to the city council as a review action. Next one. Pending.
I'll entertain a motion.
I move that we recommend the proposed amended Lakeshore Trail subdivision plat to city council for approval.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Discussion? Vote, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Great.
Okay. Let me add a totally unrelated item. We called the audible last night and added the economic and housing plan. And I realized right before the meeting that the actual economic and housing plan is not included.
Was that because of my comment to Dropbox or not?
That was part of it. I thought you were referring to something else. Because there's lots of documentation on housing. There's lots of documentation that we have on housing right now. So I wasn't sure what you were speaking about exactly.
Well, it was item 7 said the moderate income housing plan.
I didn't see your comment, but I should have heard about it.
So. Oh, okay.
But John said, well, isn't there supposed to be something with it? And then I looked and realized our error. So it is a discussion item tonight, and I'll walk you through the current plan, but you're not making any discussion. You're not making any decisions on tonight. I would like to hear some feedback.
So Chandler, are you changing the numbering on the agenda?
No.
Okay.
So do those comments show up?
Okay. I answered you back.
Oh, I haven't been back to my house.
It's okay.
In fact, I'm gonna come back to 2 items over to Jenny.
Yeah.
Discussion on carports, Plan C, park locators, and accessory structures.
Yes, please.
And Jenny, you can move the microphone closer to you. Yeah, thank you. Better? Yeah.
Okay. Hey, as all of you are aware, we do have existing carport already within the city. Looking back through our permits, it appears that these property owners have previously erected these without permits. They've been there for quite a few years. Recently, we've had a number of requests for these prefab-type carport structures. They have increased. Typically, these requests have been for properties that are either half acre or more. To an acre in size. The issue why zoning hasn't permitted these type of structures and to be able to approve these is that we don't have code for this type of a structure within our code. We do have, however, a definition for a carport, but we don't have actual code for a carport. Nothing else in the code addresses carports. The one thing that is similar to a carport that we do have is awnings, but these are attached to the house, and they're strictly different than the carport, which is strictly metal buildings. The other issue that we're finding is that none of these have met or that the property owners have provided adequate to the building department, such as engineering for seismic loads, snow loads, and wind capacity estimates to be submitted with the permits. So that's another reason why these have failed. When the property owners purchase these type of prefab structures, typically they get a great price for these. However, they fail to realize that when they submit these to the cities, they have to provide engineering to the building department. They have to accompany these with their permits when they submit these. Most of the places that sell these prefab designs typically will sell these separate than the prefab buildings at a different cost. And when the owner applies for the permit, finds out they need the engineering, and then finds out they're not permitted. In the code, under 10.529.3a states, prior to the issuing a building permit, the chief building official shall make a finding whether the material and finish of the proposed structures are in harmony with the primary structure and the surrounding as a whole, and issue a permit with a positive finding. And this is where we're having trouble with zoning permitting these type of structures. Not only do they not meet building code requirements, but these type of metal structures don't fit within these type of surroundings within the neighborhood. Looking at other city codes similar to these, the intent of our code, as it states, the words harmonious or within harmony, is very similar to ours. The building official looks at this, not only the building codes on these, but he looks at the structure to see if it distracts from the main intent of the primary structure and the surrounding neighborhood as a whole. And at that, he makes a determination to see if he would then issue out a permit. I know it sounds like, okay, it's just a metal building, but some of the requests I've had can be a little bit scary. I've had one request that he wants to turn in quite a few cargo containers into a shed. Now, my imagination can go very wild with this type of how this is going to turn out. It may turn out beautiful, I don't know. But upon the design, as it goes to the building official, it would be his determination on how this is going to impact on the neighborhood as a whole. So I've got a few examples.
It has come off of Pinterest because there's do-it-yourself tiny houses.
Yeah, well, and like I say, when you get on the internet and you start looking at a few of these, they can get pretty creative. So if you just want to pass a few of these around, yeah. And another thing to consider too is the color. Color may not be a big distraction, but if you look something like this.
She hasn't had anything for something like that, you know, for another child.
Well, you know, and I know that.
That does look like something from North Carolina where I grew up. That's a little rough.
But
Christmas lights, top of
I know I don't want to infringe on anybody's creativity, but especially this. This is a house out of Harriman. It's called
Rainbow
the
House.
And they built this. But if you look in the background of the surrounding homes around it, they're all kind of a neutral color with that. Especially that pink house that I see. Oh,
now, that's
house.
Their First Amendment freedom of expression going on here. So.
Well, it's fine if that's something you want to live in.
In Virginia, they're all like useful preservation stuff.
Isn't it that China is shipping so much more stuff to us than we're shipping to them? And so there's abundance of these containers at, you know, pennies on the dollar.
They really are. And they're trying to dump these containers. And people can literally pick these up at a very low cost. And people, if you go look on the internet, all you have to do is type in shipping containers, and you can type in tiny houses, and you can come up with a array of different ideas. And mind you, some of these look pretty good, but some of them, oh boy, they've even built some apartment houses out of these, which may solve our low-income housing. But you know, what I'm saying is it distracts from the neighborhood.
Is there a different font we can use for sarcasm?
Exactly.
Okay, so let's say that one of these very, very large equestrian lots who has a nice barn puts one of these underneath the side of their barn where it's not really visible. Maybe the front of it could be visible if you drove around to see it or something, but it's not visible.
Okay, what I'm talking about is the aesthetics of the building. Now, it would have to meet building code and the aesthetics. So this is where the building official would come in, and if it would meet building code, and what he would have to make that determination.
Right, but the way it reads, it prohibits you from having them for more than 2 weeks unless you're moving, or unless you've got an active construction permit for it to house materials and tools. So if I had a barn which was big enough to house one of these, I couldn't have it slid out of view inside the barn for storage to keep vandals or pests out of my feet or something like that, even though it's not visible to the public. This reads it's not allowed to be on my property.
Okay, now this is why it's up for discussion.
Right, so that's what I'm asking. Is that what it's saying? Is that
you're reading number seven here, right?
It's not allowed to be on the property?
With the conditions, it's an open container. It would have to be visible from the public. I mean, we would have to draft code for it to be visible.
Right.
In that case.
Yeah, unless it's... Well, let's say I've got my construction company that I'm sort of running out of my farm, because there's some farms that seem to do this. And so I've got two of these that I moved to different places, and I happen to leave one there for a month. Is that in violation of the scope?
That would be something we would have to determine.
Well, the way the code's written now, yes.
That's what I'm asking. Like,
yeah.
Okay, it is.
I mean, that would be something we would have to make a determination on. Would we allow it for 2 weeks? Would we allow it for 90 days? I mean, that would be something we would have to come to an agreement on. I guess I'm trying to understand.
Do you want it
to be permanent, or do you want it to be temporary?
Well, let's say it's related to my business and or farm, and I am using it for, you know, one of those purposes. It's not really in the public's view. Like, if I drove down the street, maybe I couldn't see it, but it's on the property. That's a violation according to the code, but... that's what I'm trying to figure out, if that's what we're saying. Like, it can't be on the property. A Connex box cannot be on the property more than 2 weeks. Period. Right?
That's the way it's written right now.
That's the way it's written right now.
Okay. Unless we draft it where it's hidden from or obscured from the street view.
Well, these are things I'm trying to...
Yeah. I mean, that would be something we would have to discuss that. If that's something you would like me to go back and take a look at, I mean,
not necessarily. I'm just trying to make sure that I've got the intent of it before we...
So the intent of it is that we don't want people to use these as accessory structures.
Right.
Okay. What if you added in language that stated that it could be housed within a greater structure? Because thinking about your example of it inside of a barn, I don't know why anyone would have a problem with that.
If it was actually inside the structure.
So it's like completely housed within another structure.
But why would somebody do that?
He gave a good example to lock up feet
or tools.
Yeah.
So, I mean, then you beg the question of why doesn't your barn have doors? But...
No.
But you can always throw out a hypothetical in any situation, but the idea, the number of lots in the city that would build a barn and then put a Landsea container in it are...
There's a dozen, maybe.
Maybe,
yeah.
So it's very few people, so...
And if somebody had a lot that big, I mean, typically I
mean, and this is the thing that... For those of you that came to the training that Brent Bateman put on last month, the city, the planning commission and the city council, you guys are the ones that determine what your community looks like. You are the ones that determine
the zoning, you know, and so if you want to say something is prohibited, you can do that.
And I'm not saying we shouldn't prohibit them. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just clarifying that's what we're doing.
Right.
Right now that's what we're doing, because I think that from the staff's perspective, that's been the feedback we've received from anybody that we've spoken with about it, is we don't want to see land sea containers in the community as structures, as permanent structures, I used to say.
And there's a difference between a lot that's a third of an acre that's mine size, surrounded by a bunch of stuff, and one of these equestrian lots or one of these farm lots that's huge, that has three or four accessory structures on it already, and, you know, construction equipment moving in and out. Like, there's a difference there, and do we want to address that? It's, I guess, no question.
Large equestrian lots like that in the city? Yeah, I think you're like talking less than a half dozen.
Right.
I can see if there's if you start going down that
path. And I think that's why it's sometimes for cities it's easier to just say no, find a different storage solution.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'll jump in and play devil's advocate. I've got a guy that I used to work with, Zana. Well, 3/4 of an acre lot in Woodland Hills. 0.20 these down, threw a roof on it so it had a pitched roof, painted it so it looked like it was wood sided, and that's his shed. And he loves it because wind doesn't affect it, rain doesn't get into it, animals can't get into it, you can lock it, it's steel walled, and that's his shed, so he never has any trouble. And I've seen it, been to his house. It's not an unattractive shed. It's not beautiful.
If that's our standard of judgment, it's not unattractive.
But it's, our neighbors have a shed that is painted brown and has a shingle roof. And the difference between the two is split in hairs, other than his is wood instead of steel. So it's not an enormous difference in appearance. Now, had he just plunked the container down on some cinder blocks and left it the way it was, it's hideous. They're rusty. They look cheap.
Well, the problem is how are you going to regulate that?
Yeah, well, again, I was playing devil's advocate.
Well, good job. Then there's the building official's review of these accessory type structures, and is it harmonious? And this is very subjective, this clause in here.
Well, but there's another. Of everything in there, what I'm worried about was that. Well, because that's not very. It's not just clear.
It isn't clear.
Yeah. It says about the materials.
Yeah.
No materials is going to be made out of the material.
Not here.
I actually agree with that. And that's what we're talking about.
Not here.
Well, in Woodland Hills, his houses are made out of steel ether, let's be honest. Actually, like the way that language reads, I think having the material similar to the primary structure is essential. I want you to know, I was actually being devil's advocate. I actually don't want them in Cedar Hills, but
no.
I want to at least argue both ways on this. The only word that I had trouble with in the whole code is written was harmonious.
Can I address that for just a second?
Yeah, I would like to, because I'm a little uncomfortable.
Because I think you can set the standard for what, when you're talking about harmony, harmonious, what you're looking for exactly. Because I kind of get a little bit of heartburn with any nebulous clause that gives us, and I'll point to me, too much leeway in decision making and saying no, and it feels personal rather than empirical,
yeah.
Right? So I think we're trying to narrow this down by saying that it's harmonious in materials, finish, design. I think you can add color, but I think that is probably in finish as well, though. But so I think you can narrow down the categories where you're looking at and saying, are these in harmony with the overall neighborhood, with the primary structure? So if you narrow it down from just saying, is this in harmony, to do these categories fit in with the others? Are they in harmony? So you're looking at something very specific. So I think if you're going to look at harmony, if you want to take this a step further, you look at the word harmonious, but then you say, okay, what is he reviewing exactly? And then you add that.
Thoughts, comments?
I agree with Chandler. He's comparing it to the primary structure and the surrounding neighborhood. And the surrounding neighborhood.
In many neighborhoods, you wouldn't be able to do this because you may live in an HOA. We have a number of HOAs in the community where a land-to-sea container would just not be prohibited, even if we said it was.
Sure.
So it's not just the city regulations you're looking at, but I mean, we have a number of homes in the city that stick out, for lack of a better word, because they're different color than all of the others. And they're not bad. I don't think that any of them look bad, but you can just pick them out of the hill on the hillside just real fast. So I think you just want to look at all these categories and say, are these in harmony? And so if there's a category there, or there's something you want to add or remove, I think that's now's the time to have that discussion and say, broaden that, narrow it down, define it, whatever it is.
Jeremy, you're looking at that. The serials finish design.
I'm just going to ask really quick. I'm new at this, but can't the building inspector, part of this process, give certain conditions for the approval of this container that shed? I mean, if the building is there to allow it, can't that be a stipulation?
What we're trying to avoid is if it's arbitrary and capricious. If you go to a person and say, I don't like glue, then you're arbitrary and capricious and you can control it. And that's where I think what Chandler was saying is it doesn't match the house, the neighborhood, the other houses across the way. You just need something to point out and say, I don't like you someone to say no, I'm going to make up 20 points. I'd rather have something to justify it.
So can't the coding or the zoning be such that only certain material or certain designs or whatever are
we could write our zoning law that way, so yes. That's
color and stuff like that.
Well, that's what HOAs do. Yeah. And we're trying to avoid doing that.
Our code would be this
thing. It would get really real fast.
But
that's essentially what you're suggesting, is that within our zones, we limit colors, we limit the styles in our commercial zone. There are very specific styles and colors palettes in these places.
Is that a code up there?
Zone is
code. No, you're right. If you're going to go that route, then let's say that this body was like, no, I feel like we need to have a certain portion of the city that had the ability to put land, sea, cargo containers in their yard. You'd look at which portion of the city, and if I were to select one, not randomly, I'd say the R1 20,000 zone. So you have this rural, larger lot, 20,000 zone, and you say, we want to see these as conditional use. Well, then what conditions? So then you've got to ask yourself, what conditions are you going to place on them? And right now, is it a stinky mess? Is it obstruct views? I mean, that can get messy in and of itself. I personally am not a fan of the Lamsey anywhere. I just don't think that there are structures like that. I don't know. That's just me. Based on what I've heard and seen, kind of like my pulse on the city, very few people want them, and I think many more do not want to live by them. Would be my, if I were to guess on a poll of the community. I could be wrong, but that's why this is a discussion item. If in the next month you guys feel like you want to take a poll of your neighbors and say, hey, how would you like it if I had a cargo container in my backyard? You know, find out for yourself. See what they say. I mean, we got people here from a good portion of the city. I'd be curious. Oh, he won't.
Yeah, I think I have one other question.
Okay.
This is in section, so it's in 10.5.29. And this is under three F. Says detached parcels. And my question or concern there is, I think that parcels often are attached to primary structure.
If I were to define those to make me understand it better, I would say that if it's attached to the home, we would call it an awning.
Yeah.
I think that's how we treat it on staff, if I'm not correct.
Yes, that would be the clear definition for that. And there's different building codes for if they're attached to the house versus if they're freestanding.
So, I had some additional questions about carports and materials. So in H, there's prohibited materials, which are corrugated metal, fiberglass, and fabric. So I understand the fabric, possibly the fiberglass because of sun damage. But metal, although it's not quite harmonious, like it's one of the more durable materials that can be built from.
And if you look at that metal, corrugated metal, there's a whole spectrum of different type of corrugated metal.
There is.
So that is up for discussion on what that would be. To be honest with you, I really don't know how to define that and how that spectrum, where we would land on that spectrum if we would allow that.
And then other than a stick-built one, that's probably the only one that could handle snow and wind load. Out of all these materials,
I think so.
Yeah.
So I mean, I think it's an appropriate material as long as it matches the character and color and whatever else of the surrounding.
Yeah. If you go down to Metal Mart, you can see like if you go for the grain dull metal, metal gray, and different things. I mean, versus they have really nice different color metal. That you can go with.
And like a standing seam metal roof is allowed for residential code.
That's what I was asking. So residential code, you can have the seamed metal.
Yeah.
But that's not corrugated, right? That's
you're not, no wavy panels, right? But,
yeah.
But, I mean, again, like she said, there's 50 different ways to do corrugated metal.
Yeah,
so.
It is. And like I say, that's going to be very difficult to try to regulate. Where that's going to be.
But definitely fiberglass and fabric are two materials I would not recommend using for something that's going to be a permanent addition to a developed wall.
Yeah.
There's one on my street that I think would be affected by this.
I have a small nice question about awnings. And this is actually not in code. I'm proposing amendment. I think it's in the original.
Okay. He's got come.
See here, the awning shall be no closer than 1 foot to the property line, no higher than 7 feet at the point nearest the property line.
Okay, I knew this was going to be brought up.
That one, surprising. That's kind of low.
This
can be kind of low.
Before my time.
Yeah. Oh, no,
which?
So, legacy.
From what I understand.
For me. Wait, I'm sorry, I missed the reference. What was the reference, John?
It's on the second page of this. C.
Number 4.
I did talk to Jeff. Jeff, he's here before that.
C. Yeah.
Like, my wife and I both would just hit our heads every time we got in the car.
So, you have one of those?
No, if we had one that.
If 6 feet. The top of the roof is 7 feet, you've got your structure. That's 6 feet.
Yeah, I'm 6'5", so it's hitting me right here every time.
Yeah. From what I understand, and this was, like I say, before.
Sure.
It was to accommodate those properties that had a small side setback that requested an awning to be a foot from the property line.
Right, up to the property line, right.
But they were able to park their four-wheelers underneath there, but it wouldn't be able to accommodate for a truck or a vehicle underneath those. That's now, I haven't gone back and looked at how that was proposed, but this is hearsay of how I understand it was brought about. Hmm. So
unfortunately, how it got there is kind of less of our issue right now, since we're proposing amending all this.
But it does, unfortunately, it does have to have that 3 feet of fire code underneath that fire or awning for fire protection. So it does have to meet that.
Sure. And I'm not trying to. I wouldn't detract from that. Mm. But that's fire separation distance. So. Is it an awning? Is that 3 feet mean separated from the house by 3 feet? Or the last 3 feet?
The last 3 feet of the awning. And it can be a foot from the property line.
It's not the property line side of the
property. Yeah, and I believe
it's the house side.
It's directly off the driveway. It can be a 412 pitch.
Right.
And it can be a foot from the property line.
Do you have any visuals on this?
Yes.
That would be very helpful.
I unfortunately didn't bring any. I believe.
We can make some.
Well, we can make some.
Yeah, I think that would be helpful.
We'll come prepared with some visuals on this one next time.
So, because I am confused by this. I thought an awning had to be attached to the house.
It does. And these are attached to the house.
So what's the 3 feet? Is it the first 3 feet after it's attached to the house?
No, this is the fire separation between the homes.
So you
between homes, between one home and another. Got it. So if you had an awning and they had an awning, you still have to maintain 3 feet.
Yes, it's the fire separation.
Got it. Okay. I was thinking between the house and its awning attached. And I...
That doesn't make any sense.
Right. That didn't make any sense, and that's why I was confused.
So,
the part by the property line, and if you are 1 foot from the property line, I very much understand the 7 feet. To me, I just don't.
I think specifically the code was to accommodate for these four-wheelers.
Sure. And I think about my home where they've done a pad the size of my garage. Mm-hmm. I can put an awning over it. That pad goes 1 foot through the property line on mine. So I understand why. But I'm much more concerned with the no higher than at 1 foot is fine, but if you're 10 feet from the property line, having that be 9 feet might be a lot nicer.
And looking at the code, I believe that it is only referring to if you bring the awning a foot to the property line. If you go up further on the code, it addresses the awning.
Okay.
I don't have it in front of me, I apologize.
That way. It says 7 feet at the point nearest the property line. I'm afraid there is some ambiguity in there.
Okay.
Or it can be interpreted that way. Maybe while we're cleaning this up, we could address that.
Yeah, okay. I see what you're saying.
So somebody who has one of these split driveways, like down on, is it Applewood? No. What's down here across from the school, in that subdivision behind there. There's some that have concrete driveway that goes up, that's split in the middle and goes into one garage and into the other. Somebody could put one right here. I mean, like on one of those, they could have an awning.
I'm not visualizing.
Is this in the front setback?
Yeah.
No, you can't do a front awning.
Nothing in the front.
You can't do
that.
Not the
front setback. Side and the rear setback.
Okay. So let's say it's on the side setback. So you've got pull in two garages that are facing each other.
Okay.
And there's a shared driveway in the middle. You could potentially put one of these
on a side.
That could be horrible.
That's exactly what we're talking about here.
Unfortunately, we can't draft code that makes everyone happy. I see what you're saying, though.
You've got a house with a garage here and a garage here, and your driveway becomes pretty much like this. And somebody could, and so this is your front elevation here. So somebody could really put one of these right here, right?
I don't know why they would, though, because they'd be covering...
I don't know why people do lots of things.
That's a fair statement.
I know, I'm with... I'm with you.
And please be aware, with all awnings and all carports, they do
okay.
have to have building permits. Even if they're under the 200 square feet, they do have to.
So, so in your scenario, it's an awning in front of a garage entrance, basically.
Which a lot of people seem to, or at least
I've never seen one.
Beside their garage entrance or whatever. So let's say then that, you know, it was a little different, and they do still have this driveway, but the garage entrance was on the front instead, and they could put one right beside it, right up to
that's
the property
much,
line.
That's much less weird to me.
It's still weird.
No,
that's very much like
that's just like a cover of the RV pad.
Yeah.
To me, the weird scenario is when you have an awning, the in your scenario of an awning coming off the front of a garage entrance. That to me, that is just that's visually weird. Does not compute.
But
if the garage is a front loading garage and you still and it's on the side of the house and on that side you put an awning next to that. To me, that's just a covered RV pad.
Yeah.
But
that's much less strange to me. That one seems very normal.
But if there's no privacy fence, there's zero lot line between the
garages. This would actually be my scenario in where I live.
Okay.
If my neighbor put an RV pad or a carport next to me. Yeah. It would not strike me as visual. I wouldn't struggle with it visually.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if they put it in front of their garage, like an overhanging awning over their garage leading away from it, that would strike me as very odd.
Okay, having said that, this is clearly the situation.
We are.
This is clearly the situation where 7 foot max would apply. Mm-hmm. You're within a foot of the property line. 7 foot high. You're not. I don't know what RV you've got, but
7 feet should only apply.
The height of it is 7 feet. On that edge.
My tent trailer might go under there.
Your tent trailer might, if it's down, to pop up.
Yeah.
Okay, it could go under. 4x4s could go under. Little four
so,
wheelers, whatever.
Yeah,
but
7.
I can't park my van under that.
Oh, 7 feet's too small.
Well, 7 feet's going to be the top edge of the outside of the roof. You're 6 foot inside.
Well, the reason we're bringing this up is because of the permit that we talked about two or three times ago, where the guy wanted to. The 40x20.
His carport though, which has not been constructed yet, but his carport was honestly nowhere near his property line.
Right.
So in the case we're talking a hypothetical here where he's
sure.
where you've got an adjacent neighbor who is a library whisper away and. That's much different than if I'm just putting one on my carport or on my cement pad and I have another half acre next to me. And that one, I mean, make it 15 feet on the side. I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
That's much less intrusive.
As long as it meets
so, but the 7 feet should only apply when it's 1 foot away.
It's 1 foot away from.
So if you're five, you know, you should get a height distance really ratio there. I see where that's really.
When awnings do come in where they don't meet this criteria are approved at a higher than 7 feet.
I just think it's a lot bigger so it's written.
It is. I see that.
If we have the opportunity to clean it up, let's clean it up.
Okay.
So let's... There's a lot in here. Where's the part about the size of... Size allowed for a carport. We had a maximum size allowed, right?
I think it was 24 feet in its longest dimensions. The very front under terms defined.
Yeah, okay, so very first thing.
And that's open to discussion.
Well, so just because kind of what triggered all of this was the gentleman requesting this. His was 40.
Okay.
Again, he's grandfather prior to this, so it doesn't affect him directly.
I mean,
24 feet.
To be honest, this is just code that it was taken from another city. So this is, like I say, this is just open to discussion, and
sure.
we can retrofit this how we want it.
I'm not being critical. I'm just questioning.
24 feet to just kind of give you a size dimension. If you go into a parking lot and they have a nice wide stall for a truck, like a normal size truck.
Yeah.
It's going to be 10 by 20. So this gives you 2 feet on either side of that truck if you were to park a truck under a carport, to kind of give you a visual.
Well,
so 24 feet would be enough to put a very large vehicle under, but not in one by one.
Now, how long is a nice motorhome? How long is it?
Depends on.
I've never
had how nice are we talking
how
about?
How nice.
$60,000 or $80,000
I have no idea.
Prevost chassis.
I would say that they're probably 30 feet, maybe.
They're 36 feet.
Yeah.
So it's a
longer than this.
Longer than this.
Yeah. Longer than the 24 feet. I'll guarantee
are we
that.
Longer than 24 feet. Are we trying to make accommodations for them to be able to put those in cover parking?
I think that's the idea. If so, then these need to be lengthened, but it shouldn't spill into the front setback.
I agree with setbacks. Okay. It needs to stay inside the rear setback.
Okay.
So in that case, would we also need to accommodate for the height of the motorhome as well?
If you've got the space, I mean,
if you're far enough from a property line,
yeah.
I don't see that.
No, this is carport. This is
yeah. This is
yeah. Oh.
Yeah, so but the carport should have the same rule. Whatever we set for the awning at the property line, 1 foot away from the property line, I feel should be with the carport as well.
So a carport
has to be inside setback. Completely inside setbacks.
So it can't
be a foot from the property.
No, the carport is different than.
Oh, are we treating it?
Yeah,
we're treating
it
under
completely
this.
Different.
What setbacks? Like just the accessory structure setbacks?
Attached carports are permitted on the side of their setbacks.
My misunderstanding. I apologize.
Yes.
Okay, I like that.
But a pole barn, a carport, an RV, awning.
They're all technically the same thing,
but could vary in size significantly.
Okay, so this is where it comes back to customary residential accessory building, because where you
that's
go
a new
with
term
this,
for us here.
That is for me.
Depending on what zone you're in, you can either go with the 20 foot or the 20. Was it 25 foot? Did we go with
20 or 25?
That's the height, and we changed that 6 months ago
for the one zone.
For the one zone.
Yeah.
So they would have to stick with the zone that they're in. That would be the maximum height that they would go.
20 feet, though, should be pretty high. That's higher than a lot of those rambler homes that you see in.
I'm not worried about the height nearly as much as I'm thinking about these agricultural lots back here. Like,
and you are their advocate tonight.
I am. I really am.
Are you thinking the hay barns? Or?
Yeah, exactly like that. Like, what's the difference between a pole barn or a hay barn and this? And is there a difference?
We allow the hay barn up to 25 feet, though,
yeah,
in those agricultural lots.
The length is different.
So 24 feet is the starting point. What length do you want to see?
I'm not sure, but like if my permit comes in and I want to build a hay barn on my big lot.
Are you calling it a carport or are you calling it a hay barn?
What he's saying is he can call
structurally, it's exactly the same thing. Is it a rose or is it a flower? I mean, it's the same thing.
It's not the same because the carport is not a hook.
But a pole barn isn't either. This is a fair question.
I think.
Yeah. No. We're just talking about a roof with poles, and you park it and put hay in.
Well, and so if you get permission to build a pole barn, so you build a pole barn, then you park your RV under it.
How dare you?
Exactly. That's what I'm getting at. So I could build a pole barn and put two or three or four RVs in if I really wanted to because it's big enough. But I can't get a carport that's exactly the same construction that's a different size because this. Do you see where I'm going with this?
Being an advocate for a dozen lots in the city.
I am, but when we make a rule, it applies to every lot in the city.
That's correct.
So that's what I'm trying to get at here,
is that if we're making a rule, it's got to apply to everybody, or it needs to have flexibility where it appropriately applies to everyone.
Okay, well, what I determine when a permit comes in is when they come in, they determine, they write on the permit, what are you building? Are you building a carport? Are you building a pole barn? What are you building? And I make the determination, and I go from this pole from what they put on the permit. And that's how I make my determination from this building side of it, everything inside of it. That's how I make my determination. So it's really hard for me to say, okay, future-wise, are you going to park some RVs under there? I don't really, it doesn't matter to me, right? Because you come in as a pole barn after you got that permit at that point. It doesn't really matter whether you park RVs under it or not. You've got permitted for that at that point.
Do we care on the length if they meet the setbacks and the size requirements for the lot? Should we care?
And I'll give you my opinion. I don't think we should care.
I mean,
if it's in the setbacks. If
it meets the setbacks and it meets all zoning requirements, like meaning it's not covering up half of your backyard and it's not protruding into the front setback and it's not too close to the property line, okay. I guess the question I'm asking right now, do we care?
I think that one reason we may care is because it's open.
Just because it's open?
Yeah.
Open, when you say open, what do you mean?
Well, think about the difference between, and this is mostly visual for the neighbors, but the difference between having a 36-foot enclosed structure versus a 36-foot open structure.
But if I park my bus RV in it, it's full of bus RV.
And what if you stack it with junk?
Oh, yeah. Actually, that's it.
That's a good point.
Okay.
On the other hand, is 24 feet of junk significantly different from 36 feet of junk? No, from a length standpoint.
If I was a neighbor, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, any less junk
is 50%
more. No, that's valid point.
I mean,
do you require them to be closed after a certain length then? Say up to 24 feet open, and then past 24 feet it has to be closed?
Well, we've already sort of codified that by saying maximum length on open carport is 24.
Well, this is proposed
right.
new definition, so it's not in code yet.
So if you're saying, because I think this brings up a good point.
That's actually a really good
point. There's been a lot of good points made tonight. I mean, past a certain length, close.
Time.
I mean, what are your thoughts?
She
brings the good ones.
I would say, yeah. If it's more than
24. This is what I do every day.
I don't have an issue with that.
But
Mr. Thomas, yeah.
That's
the pole barn thing.
The pole barn and the apple farm, and it's totally appropriate to have an open building there because I'm storing hay in it and putting a tractor under it, and you know, my horses may hang out under there when it's snowing. Whatever it is, that's totally appropriate there. In my third of an acre lot over here, it's not at all appropriate to have an enormous pole barn or an enormous carport.
Okay, the difference here, though, is that one lot is obviously designated for agricultural purposes versus one is to store all of my things. Possibly a truck. I don't know.
Maybe.
So, I don't know. That could be a distinction where you draw the line.
My
It's a fine line there, though. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, my idea is they're all like this with poles underneath them. And they look exactly the same, and they're built exactly the same. The only thing is scale. The only difference is scale. So, why are we calling one thing and calling one something else? It's like saying, I have a truck, or I have a light truck, or a heavy truck, and they're all built on the same chassis. One just happens to have a diesel in it and a heavier rear-end axle. It's the same truck. This is the same pole barn, / carport, / awning. It's just whether it's beside my house or whether it's on a farm, and they're all allowed in the city.
Okay.
You could call one of
them. Okay, what about this? Following that train of thought, what if accessory structures were kind of put into two buckets then? open accessory structures and enclosed accessory structures.
I like that. Well, hold on. How does that change? The pole barn is still going to be an open accessory structure, right?
You're right, it does.
And it's huge.
It does.
Okay.
It can be huge.
Not all pole barns are open, though.
Not all pole barns are open. There's one on Canyon Road that's enclosed. It's the red one there. Mm. That's in Cedar Hills.
I just drove 1,200 miles on I-80 a week and a half ago.
There were a lot.
Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these that I see.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Nebraska, Iowa, Illinois. Trust me, I saw more than I wanted to see. Okay. And they are everywhere. They're pole barns, but they are there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they're huge.
But I'm saying that there are pole barns that are enclosed as well.
Oh, absolutely.
And this is, I mean, this is, in my, how many pole barns have you approved in the city?
Currently, recently, one.
I can think of one before that. So in the last 6 years, I can think of two.
Okay.
No, and I'm not saying that you should ignore. I'm just saying, like, this is a situation that doesn't come up nearly as often as carports itself.
Right. No. I'm with you on that.
Okay.
I'm just trying to make sure that if we're making a rule, that it either applies or there's a cutout somewhere for the exception.
What about this? What if there's a square footage limitation on open accessory structures where we're not determining the depth or the width? We're simply saying it can't be bigger than this square footage wise.
Square footage or percent of lot or...
Percentage of lot, I don't know. That percentage of lot might be a good one.
Percentage, it can be over 50% of the rear setback area.
Right, so that it has to meet all of the setbacks and everything else. So this 1 foot, 7 foot thing might still apply. But if I want a bigger one, then I'm going to make sure that it hits all of the setbacks as an accessory structure.
Right.
But isn't the size of an auxiliary building subject to the size of the lot?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes, it is.
So you've got that restraint already built in. Which to me is one of the biggest factors because it needs to be proportionate.
Right.
And the bigger your lot, the more chance it is it's going to be somewhere in the back as opposed to on the side right next to your neighbor.
Okay. I'm trying to throw out any ideas and see if they stick here. Because we're talking about carports, and I think our main concern here is carports that are on the side setback that are adjacent to another property.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily ones that are in a rear setback that are kind of hidden from view. So
yes.
What if the size limitation was for specifically carports? Probably puts a pole barn on their side setback.
Well, no one puts a carport in their backyard and you can't drive up to it.
So a car, maybe that's part of the definition,
well,
is on the side setback.
And you have access to this driveway because we talk about driveways.
So you limit the carport to the side setback, pole barns to the rear setback, and carports have a size limitation. Pole barns don't.
Well, pole barn would be
portions
in the lot.
Let's do the lot
size. Well, right, they don't have a size. They have a size limitation just as any other accessory structure does.
Okay, help me define this right now.
I can't. I don't know.
Just listen to that.
Listen to
this. Thanks, guys.
We're really helpful tonight.
Yes.
All right. Okay. I'm gonna...
One of the key components, I think, is the carport is on the driveway on the side, as opposed to pole barn being on the side next to the neighbor.
Okay, we want to strike the dimensions on this.
I think on the carport you can, if it's on the side setback there, I think you probably could limit it with a square footage.
Okay.
That's large enough to accommodate an RV, but must still remain within the setbacks.
Has to be within the setbacks.
So it has to be within that side setback area. It can't protrude into the front. It can't protrude into the rear. It has to be in the side. And it's got a square footage limitation,
yes.
Which you can make that as wide or as deep based on your need.
If you're in the setbacks.
Precisely.
Did you say it's high?
No, wide and deep.
See, that's a potential problem with certain houses because the carport could be taller than the the main structure. Then it wouldn't be harmonious.
How? What home are we talking about specifically? Is there a really small home I'm not aware of?
Well,
the one at the end of my street, that is a huge garage. Remember that?
That is
all
true.
Of these awning.
Can you so then at no point will the carport be higher than the main dwelling?
Well, I'm saying that, but
I mean, we're getting pretty specific here.
If you're talking about a carport on the side of the home, some of these same principles that exist in the awning specs apply. For example, probably the roof pitch must slope away from the main building.
Yeah,
but the car, the carport would.
Okay, but how much separation would that have?
What, so what
they,
they're saying.
They don't have to have any separation from the house, but they cannot be attached to the house.
So they can go right up by the house,
by
but
the
they
house,
can't be attached.
They can't be attached.
But an awning can.
An awning is.
An awning is, but
it has different building code regulations.
Right, and what they're saying is you can't be sloped towards the house because the water and leaves will puddle there and it'll be a problem.
I think you could still slope it towards the house.
Can.
You just have to have a rain gutter there somewhere
to contain the water,
contain the water on your property.
I think you can. Again, people do things that
people are creative.
People do stuff.
Okay, we'll go back to the drawing board and come back to something here.
Yes.
With the extent of the potential changes, we probably need to table this to some extent.
Oh, this is a discussion anyway.
Oh, discussion item. It's coming back.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, real quick, is this actually, I saw you propose code. And then my backyard, swimming pools.
Move to
okay.
Come back to things.
We don't
room.
Really
this
have
a
yeah,
great code for swimming pools. Mainly this was brought about for fencing regulations. We really want to accompany the code with some type of fencing restrictions.
Sure.
To go down
sure.
For safety.
What if I have a pergola with a hot tub under it? Is that a fence?
A pergola is not a fence.
A pergola is not a fence.
So I have to fence my backyard
yeah,
or fence that to put a hot tub under it?
State regulations for fencing or barrier around hot tubs, pools.
And your insurance company
will
find out when I'm sure you're home if you don't.
I can actually.
But I've seen hot tubs just sitting kind of in people's backyards
yeah.
A lot.
Now they can have the perimeter
yes,
can be fenced.
No, I just kind of, there's just kind of
yeah.
Hot tubs
I think,
in some people's backyards.
I think the difference is that when you get a swimming pool, it's a little bit more involved. There, you know, there's excavation that comes
oh,
in.
Oh, sure, sure.
And there's inspections that come in into play. When you get a hot tub, they drop it off and you fill it up with your hose and plug it in.
It's KSL and you plug it in.
Right. So,
like
it's, so like there's not somebody from the city coming by and saying, oh my gosh, you don't have a fence. And I don't know exactly what the state regulations are on a hot tub versus a swimming pool. But I do know that it's much easier to regulate that when it's a swimming pool.
No, and that was kind of my thought when
yeah,
I read this is, wow, that's going to be really hard to enforce other than just, oh, my neighbor has a hot tub and they don't have a fence. You should do something about that. Like, that's going to be how you're going to
see
it.
See,
and grandfather,
if
we can't make it, you know, actual factor. We can't
well, actually,
factor.
The state's code supersedes our code.
Yeah, it would.
So it already exists.
It already exists.
So this is what the state code says on
mm-hmm.
these is that
well, no,
if
not this
spa,
specific,
okay.
But their state code actually calls out where those, it has to have some type of security feature for those hot tubs or
swimming so like a locked cover.
They're
yeah.
Attractive businesses.
Because, I mean, a locked cover on a hot tub is going to do just as much good as a locked gate around a swimming
probably
pool.
Probably more.
Probably more.
But.
Well, and that's what that's seems to be what I'm. So I mean, it says here, the swimming pool and spa or the entire property shall be walled or fenced. Like if there's not a, it can be locked. It can be inside of a screen pergola. It can be like there's none of that.
There's,
it says,
what it calls out for is there's a 4-inch minimum spacing between the fencing.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be self-closing, self-latching gate. It has to be a certain, like 4 inches above the ground.
For a pool, though.
Or a swimming pool.
Right, but this new revised code says
We just need to go back and look at the hot tub code.
Yeah, we'll
make sure it's.
Yeah, on that particular.
I don't know that we want to be any more stringent than what the state says.
Yeah, my question about the pools.
Okay.
There are pools and there are pools. They're in ground and above ground, and they're actually really different construction. I think this applies to both.
I believe it does. I don't think that the state calls out the difference between.
Okay.
Between them, but I will go back and check that. Okay.
Because we've gotten the ground pool in our backyard.
The $400 Costco one that if you bump into it the wrong way.
$4,000 heated.
Cool. There's a big.
Got a pool, which yeah. You just have to post $400. You can't pay the electric bill. The real concern, and I want you to know, I ran out the backyard for 10 years to find out how far from my property line it was. And it's 10 foot 6 inches, so there, which is very fortuitous because when I put it in,
you're not moving it?
We didn't measure it, and I am not moving it.
Guesswork.
It was guesswork. Okay. So this is new. I just noticed this is all new. We're not even revising. This is new. And
as
I
far
actually
as
approve,
the swimming
like
pool setback, that is just calling it out a little bit better than what it was.
Yeah.
Fencing, that is new there. Now, on the spas, they're actually allowed in the side setback areas.
Really?
Yeah. On that one. So I've got to.
But it's supposed to be behind a fence.
Yeah, it just has to be secured.
So does there have to be a building permit pulled to install any kind of pool?
Yes.
Okay, so above ground.
I'm not sure about ground. I've got to check with
Well, so if there's not, I think there should be.
Okay. I can check with that. I'm not sure on that one. Some of these, they're just.
Because then you're going to.
Depending on the size, I think a lot of that is. Some of these you can buy at Walmart.
Well, like a waiting pool or something, no. But,
yeah.
But I mean, anything that it's set up that you can't dump out and move, like I think should be permitted. Because then you're going to do checks like, is there a fence? Is everything in compliance? Do you have, you know, adequate.
Yeah, I believe under our nuisance code, there is something that has for unsecure pools that does call those out. And in those cases, I have sent out notices to property owners that notifies them that they need to get a fence around their pools because there are complaints. Because, frankly, property owners are nervous for young children with those unsecure pools.
Young children, pets, wildlife.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of things that could go wrong. So, I mean, I'm thinking even the inexpensive, you know, I put it up myself above ground pools, like, I think there should be some regulation around that.
Right. And I think a lot of that depends on the size that you're going for there. So, but I'll check with Jeff and see what the building permit requires for that.
See, I go both ways.
Is there
really hard to defend people?
Any other burning things in your
life? No. Mr. Fink.
Steve, did you have anything else?
I've been doing big. Cause enough trouble.
Okay, I think the last one, if there's no more discussion.
Are we good? You got direction on that?
Yep, I think I do.
Excellent.
I believe
so. On to the next item then.
The last one I have is discussion on second driveway access for accessory ADU apartments. What we're finding out is with the approval of these new ADUs, some portion of these driveways with homeowners that have restricted driveways on a portion of their homes, they don't have enough access on the portion of their driveway to accommodate for a 10 by 20 size space parking area. So what this would do would be to allow for a proposed park separate driveway to go within their property, which would also allow for 50%, maintain 50% landscaping. In accompanying with this, they would still have to go through the permit process with curb, gutter, sidewalks. They would have to maintain that, work with the public works director with the proper permits, and then be able to use these parking driveways, hard surface pavers, what they needed to make these second driveways. They would have to be able to go to the side setback areas of the home for the parking areas. It wouldn't be a front parking area within the front side of the home.
My driveway is three spaces across already. Like,
okay.
I couldn't do that.
So that wouldn't, this wouldn't apply to you, your condition. So
okay.
These would be for strictly for property owners that have two spaces with for their driveway. They may have maybe 5 foot, say, on the right side of the driveway, and then there's your property line.
Mm.
They don't have enough space to accommodate, to pour behind the sidewalk area, to accommodate for another parking area.
Okay.
So they would, on the other side, or if they lived on a corner, to make another driveway access to accommodate them to coming, depending on how their plat laid out. It would have to go through the approval process, make sure it would meet all setback requirements, approval process to allow for them so that these parking areas would be located in the front setbacks of the home.
And they are driveways we're talking about, not parking areas.
Driveways. So these would be approved driveways going back to a parking, approved parking areas.
Sometimes I'm just a visual learner.
I'm
not seeing this in my head.
Okay. Okay, so say this is a property here.
Mm-hmm.
This is a driveway here. Access in. Property is here. This guy has an apartment that comes down here.
Mm-hmm.
He does, he's only got 5 feet on this side.
Right.
He doesn't have enough room to put in a driveway to accommodate him back to this. Maybe this is 10 feet, sorry, this is 5 feet.
Okay.
But he does have room on this side of his home. So to be able to put a driveway on this side of his home, come back and do a parking area on this side of his home to accommodate, to come down to the stairs to meet his apartment.
So the approval is required for the second driveway?
It is. So it's a requirement. So if he wasn't able to have a parking area for this, he wouldn't be able to have an ADU.
I think we need to address that, though, in that we'll talk about it more when it comes to affordable housing, but I think that the two parking spots in front of the drive in front of a garage should be able to count towards an ADU because it's leading to a parking area, a parking garage, or a legal parking area.
Off street parking now.
But, there's been a case where there's just been a cement pad poured in front setback and doesn't lead to anything, and that's the one I have problems with. If that led to the side, then that's great, but just a cement pad in the front just doesn't do it for me. It's gotta go somewhere.
And we do have quite a few second driveways in the city already.
Yeah, we do.
I mean, this isn't nothing. This isn't new in the city. This would just accommodate those people with ADUs that would like a second driveway for those apartments.
And this seems like a no-brainer to me. What am I missing? Because if they meet the landscaping requirement, and we're keeping cars off of the street, what's the downside?
We need code to...
No, we need code. He's saying it's a no-brainer.
I don't see the downside.
I'm not seeing much of a downside.
No, I think there needs to be second driveway code.
Other than we're adding a lot of impermeable space to...
Well, one of the things that we are having a lot of issues with is people going in and making curb cuts. They're busting up the sidewalk. They're doing do-it-yourself type of issues.
But it doesn't change the amount of impermeable space that we already allow, because we already require 50% of your yard to be at least 50% of your yard to be landscaped.
Right.
So we're not changing that. So somebody could already do that in some fashion. So we're not changing that. So
So we're just basically calling this out a little bit better for the public works director for them that they need to follow up with the permits needed for this and to follow through on bonds.
So instead of this, you know, coming into the just and stopping in the front setback, it has to go all the way back to the side setback. That's the idea. So I can pull up beside the house rather than in front of the house.
Driveway must extend to the legal parking area beside the rear setback. Parking area cannot be limited to the front setback. I don't know how much clearer you could.
Good.
I think you just have to make sure that ADUs, if they want to have their two driveway parking spots leading to their garage, that driveway, because our ADU code requires two off-street parking spots. I think that should be able to meet that definition. As inconvenient as it is for the homeowner, that's their problem. But if that's, they can solve it. They can solve it. But it's because it's leading to a parking garage. It's the ones that don't lead to a parking garage that I personally have a problem with. Jenny may disagree with me on this one, and that's fine. But if you require all the ADUs to do that, then I think that getting the number of affordable housing units we need is going to be problematic.
Where this is going to have a real problem is in the HOAs, especially the seniors. Because they're not going to have enough room for a second driveway.
Right, so that's where you need to have that provision to say you can park in your driveway. You can use your driveway, because usually driveways are at least 40 by 40, so you can park two normal size vehicles on them. So you can call that. You know, and if the HOA has a rule that you can't, you have to have the car inside your garage at night, but that law has never been enforced in that HOA. They do enforce street parking, though. So, my thoughts. I think it just needs to be.
I need to trip. It's a little old.
Can you speak in your mic, though?
Yeah, you need to speak in the
Eric,
mic.
Will you
focus on rural
Eric.
Stuff. But I live in the city. So, you know, maybe you can tell something. But I have two neighbors. Who have recently been approved permits to put in additional parking spaces off their regular driveway, but they haven't done any additional driveway. So basically what they have to do is they have to drive up off their existing driveway and get into those slots.
That's a different... So right now our design standards for the city, and this isn't fall under code, if you go on the city's website and search design standards, it'll bring up a PDF of a book that developers or contractors would use to see how they install a sump or a storm drain. There is a design standard right now that in the city that you can't have a curb cut longer than 20 feet, right? Staff has been working on changing that to 30 feet, because 20 feet is for two car garages, 30 feet is for three car garages. You know, and it just makes sense. That as more people have had larger garages, you need to widen that curb cut. So that's a good point, but it would fall under the design standards.
And right now in our code, it just basically said no curb cuts allowed. And with this, we're trying to get that altered. And we're going to work with our public works.
They're allowed it permitted.
It permits, yes.
Yeah.
And they were said well within that 50% limitation.
Right. The reason for the 50% is we don't want a whole front yard to be cement.
My wife wants actually, but we're leaving that. Good, no way.
Easy.
Zeros.
Is there any recommendations you'd like me to do for this particular area?
Anyone? I think the proposed additions are good. Yeah, I can do it.
those 45 minute sessions.
Good job.
Chandler. Moderate income housing plan and amending the general plan.
Good to be with you tonight. Okay, so just some background. The city has a general plan, believe it or not. That general plan has not been updated in far too long. In fact, this is a big focus of the city over this last year and into the upcoming year as well. But the state law requires that the cities have three what are called elements in their general plan. One is a transportation element, one is a land use element, and one is a moderate income housing element. The city has a transportation element and they have a land use element. The land use element is wildly outdated. But the transportation one is pretty good. There's not really anywhere else we can go to collect. But the city does not have, and we're one of the few cities in the state of Utah that do not have a moderate income housing plan. So staff, Jenny and I have been working with MAG, which is the Mountain Association of Governments. They work with three counties here in this area to assist cities on various projects and transportation needs. We've been working with them on developing this moderate income housing plan based on data that's been provided from U.S. Census and other surveys. So I apologize that this was not sent out in the packet, but what we're going to do is I just want to briefly walk through this tonight, get you thinking about where we're going to go, and then next month we're going to have this up for approval or a recommendation to the City Council. This does require public hearings, so that's why it's just a discussion tonight. We wanted to just kind of pick your brains and stuff. Because as far as moderate income housing goes, we're constrained, for lack of a better word. We're not like other cities that have a large availability of land. So if you look at your packet there, in the very middle section on the front page, it says, according to Utah Code 1098103, plan for moderate income housing means written document adopted by a city legislative body that includes, in this ABCDE. And so what they've done, this packet includes ABCD. The E is a description of the city's program to encourage an adequate supply of moderate income housing. Now, moderate income housing can be kind of confusing, but I'll make an attempt to define it. So what they have it saying, moderate income housing is defined as housing occupied or reserved for occupancy by households with a gross household income equal to or less than 80% of the median gross income for households the same size in the county in which the city is located. So one of the examples I saw was if you make, the other issue is that housing is generally deemed to be affordable if the cost of monthly housing expenses is at equal to or below 30% of gross household income. So if I make $60,000 a year in my household, and that's when I break it down, that's $5,000 a month. So 30% of that income would be $1,500. 30% would be, that would have to include my rent, mortgage, and all my utilities. So this is where it becomes problematic for Cedar Hills, because just the demographics of the area, of this area, we're not the only city that has this issue. Alpine and Hyman both struggle with it as well, in that the average median income of Cedar Hills is very different than the average median income of a place, let's say, Santa or Payson. That's not to say anything about that, it's just a different
area. And this is, our rating is county, not city.
County, yeah. So and that's where it becomes difficult, because it incorporates all the areas of the county that are widespread when it comes to average median income. So,
Jim, what is motivation? Why do we care? I mean, yeah, we don't do this well, but we're not trying to be all things to all people.
We're not trying to be all things to all people. You are correct. But, unless it's farmers and Steve. But the state has really made this a priority at the legislative session year in, year out. And last year especially, the legislature was just banging the drum on the Utah housing supplies. Because right now you have more households looking for houses than there are houses available. So there's a housing stock shortage in Utah. Not only that, but the housing that's available is not affordable. So, and it's creating housing crisis, it's creating crunches, and it's creating public safety issues, mostly in Salt Lake. So you're seeing where there is, and the housing crisis extends not just to moderate income housing, but also down to low income housing, which is less than 30% of AMI and 30% of that. You can imagine what that type of income level is, and it's just incredibly low. But it has put a lot of pressure on some of these cities that are adjacent to the metro area or adjacent to some of these high transit areas where they have a large homeless population, they have homeless shelters. And one of the state bills that passed this last year was a bill that allocated a portion of the state sales tax away from cities that we used to get and redirected it to those communities that are seeing this public safety issue. And so they're getting this subsidy basically from the rest of the state in order to help them with their skyrocketing public safety costs. Now that's presented a challenge because they're also requiring the cities to come up with plans on how they're going to help alleviate that stress that those communities are feeling. And that stress level is going to be alleviated by each community developing an affordable housing plan. Now, we're still in a bit of a crunch because you go out there and I don't have developers knocking down my door saying I have this project that's going to bring in thousands of units. That's Eagle Mountain. We have infill development at this point. We're 90% plus developed. And what's left to be developed is like Parcel E on that first agenda item, where to develop it, yeah, you can do it. It's just going to cost you a lot of money. So there's not really an economic incentive to do so. So does that kind of lay some of the groundwork where we are? And the state is going to, my fear is that the state legislature is going to pass some stricter penalties on communities that are not doing their part. And so that's why I feel like it's critical that this gets passed. We may not be 100% comfortable or in love with the final product, but this is the general plan. We're going to revisit this. This is something that the city needs to be revisiting more often than every decade. This is something that should be a focus of, or a discussion item, at least, I would say, at least once a year, if not more. The housing state requires that cities resubmit their housing plan every 2 years. So this is something that is going to just be cycling through. So even if you're not in love with the final product of what we're going to pass, just know that it's coming back. And as we kind of work through it, this is the first time we've done this. So changes will be made as needed. Any questions on that? Okay. So, the housing supply, we have, according to this American Community Survey, we have 2,679 housing units at 96.5% occupancy rate, with the housing stock 66.8% of it was built after 2000. So we're obviously a very young community when it comes to the housing stock. One that kind of raised Jenny and I's eyebrow, one of the last sentence there says 20 plus unit apartments made up the remaining 5.5% of the housing units. That's what we counted it up to, like 150-ish units.
Is that the Charleston?
Where is that?
We're trying to figure that out too.
I think
we know that part of it is the Congregate Care. We're assuming that part of it is also the assisted living Beacon Heights or.
Is it Beacon Heights though?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, but that's 16 beds. So we're trying to figure out how they're defining that. If they're defining something like Bridgestone, for example, has a couple of eightplexes, if they're defining that as one apartment unit. So we're trying to gather some more information there. That number may change.
Yeah.
So anyway, and then there's just a couple other type errors that need to be figured or fixed. So it says the newer homes in Cedar Hills.
Hold on, I got a question. Sorry. Moderate and low. We're worried about moderate right here, right?
Mm-hmm. Moderate income is
on our chart. That's 59.759 or less.
Moderate is basically
the 50 to 80, right?
50 to 80.
Yeah.
And less than that. all of those categories is moderate income housing. They're redefined as like very low, low, and moderate, but moderate income housing is defined as housing is, where is it?
Yeah.
Some examples of maybe it's not this document I read, but it is all those categories.
Sure. Okay. But and again, I'm just going off the table that's in here.
Yeah.
It's saying the max mortgage amount is $300,000. I don't think that's right. If they have to include utilities, as you mentioned, I think that's if all of it went through mortgage. Right?
Which
referring to? You're looking at.
It's saying max monthly income spent on housing, which is $1,490.
No, that's the entire housing burden. It can't be more than 30% of your income. So that's utilities, expenses, everything else.
Yeah, but they give a max mortgage amount of 300. I don't think.
Okay, so let's say that 1494 times.
I don't think that's 300.
So
I mean, utilities are $50 a month. I don't think that is big enough. I think that mortgage has to be less.
Interest loan.
No, so that's 1.25 interest loan.
Nine, 10.
0 interest loan would be great. Yeah, pay that. Anyway, all I'm saying is I'm not sure those numbers. Does this come from the state or is this us?
This is actually from the Magnus table.
The Association of Government.
Okay. Sorry, I'm quibbling over something that's probably not.
No, this isn't important. Times, maybe divided by 12. Times 0.03. So I'm trying to do some quick math here. So I'm taking that 59,759 divided by 12 to get a monthly income. I have $4,979.
Times 0.3.
Times 0.3
is
1493.
Okay, I've got that.
So
how much
so
that number?
1493. So 1493
has to be the mortgage and
mortgage
utilities.
Rent, mortgage or rent and utilities.
Right.
Maybe they have a good banker. I don't know.
Well, they say they have 4.25 interest. Whatever. 30
no.
Long,
so I mean, that's I wouldn't put too much weight into the max mortgage amount because
sure.
that's going to fluctuate. Let's say you make $59,000, but you have a $300,000 down payment on a home. So there's circumstances that are just going to make that
move that around, right?
So really, the max monthly, the first column there, the yearly income and the max monthly income spent on housing,
yeah.
which does include utilities,
yeah.
those are your big categories.
Got
I think
it.
The max mortgage amount there is kind of just a rough estimate.
Sure.
So don't put too much stock into that. Because when I go to conferences and they talk about this subject, they're not talking about the max mortgage amount because that varies by person and circumstances. That's hard to peg down.
Sure.
So you have your housing supply, which we've kind of got over at this point. And one of the challenges in that third page, it's got the box with the 93% in it,
yeah.
which actually should say 1980, not 2000. But the last sentence in that box, I think, nicely highlights some of the challenges that Cedar Hills faces in terms of moderate income housing versus communities around us or communities nearby. So Cedar Hills is relatively distant from major employment centers and institutions of higher learning and transit routes when compared to other cities in the county, dampening the demand for higher density housing. Too often people equate high density housing with low income or moderate income housing. That's not necessarily synonymous. However, moderate income housing, low income housing typically is more clustered around transit areas or areas of employment. That is, you'll find one with the other. And so we're a Bedford community, and you have to basically drive because there's not a bus coming to pick you up. There's not a UTA route out here. It presents some challenges again for developing that moderate income housing. So these are problems, and I bring these up because when we report to the state can take a look at our plan and say, we don't like it. Well, that doesn't change the reality of what we're facing here. So basically, it comes into what can the city do? And I think that at this point, it's really what has the city done? So I think the biggest thing that the city can do, and has done in order to address moderate income housing, is address the need for accessory dwelling unit ADU code, which we've done in June and July. By cleaning up that process, we already allow it in the city. But the problem was the code that we had before was so convoluted, it didn't describe what the ADU should look like, what the restrictions on it should be. We didn't have a process for registering those, or what fees were they going to pay. For a couple of years, honestly, we were in disagreement on should accessory dwelling units pay an impact fee. And my stance on that was, no. If you want people to register their ADU, if you're going to take the moderate income housing crisis seriously, you have to make it easy for people to register their ADUs. You have to incentivize them to come. And if you're going to say, you can come and you can register this, but it's going to cost you $3,000 in impact fees that you've already paid for your dwelling, you're not going to get people registered. And so when I had realtors call and say, I'm looking at such and such house, they have an accessory dwelling unit, I just want to make sure it's legal, I would say we had no record of any accessory dwelling unit in the city. That's a problem, because I know that we have tons of them. They're just not legal. And so now that we've changed that code, we're seeing people come out and register their ADUs, and that's been a good thing. So that's a feather in the city's cap. So really, the last page here, has a paragraph that says programs to encourage moderate income housing, and it kind of goes over what the city did as far as developing that code for accessory dwelling units. I think we need to keep going and think about that some more. What else can the city be doing in order to address this issue? Because this is something where we have to continually develop a five-year plan year over year and say, how are we going to get there? What are we going to do? But at the same time, it's a fine balancing act, because we don't want to change the nature of our community. Cedar Hills is a great place because it's single family homes, and it is a bedroom community, and I think people like it that way. So if you all of a sudden say, well, there's no zoning restrictions, and you can put tiny homes anywhere you want, people may not like that. They may like it if it's Lancy containers, though. But I told Colleen we need to have a special font for sarcasm. And,
got them. It's called delete.
So the Matt provided this last sheet. It says example, and you have a goal, you have an objective, and then policies. And I think that's where I really wanted to have a discussion either tonight or get you guys thinking about what we can do. So beyond what we've done, what can we do? Yes.
What are Highland and Alpine doing?
Well, you should ask, because I have it right here in front of me. So Alpine says, Alpine has some unique challenges that are similar to ours. And their moderate income housing plan says, this is the point in the analysis when it starts talking about the programs and goals, policies, and objectives. It says, this is the point in the analysis where the state model may be too broad to apply to the unique characteristics of Alpine. So you can imagine what that is.
I think their average house price and median income are a little higher than ours.
It's a little bit higher to touch. But also they have some density requirements, and Highland has them as well, where they want to see throughout their community, they want to see the acre lot. They want to see the half acre lot as the zoning minimum. And quite frankly, obviously that ship has sailed for Cedar Hills. We're not doing that. But as time goes on, I think that there's going to be increasing pressure and demand for housing opportunities. And there's a number of challenges that are coming our way as a state and as a regional area. Population projections off into the next 30 years. You'll see that we're supposed to get like another 1.5 million people in just
at least,
and I might be being too conservative on that. And the real stress for the cities is, where does that water come from? If everyone can't have a half acre lot here. So I think there's going to be pressure on communities to change zoning as well. Alpine goes on and they say, additionally, there's a very limited amount of commercial businesses within the city. The majority of jobs that do exist in Alpine are either home occupations or could be categorized as small office businesses, such as mortgage companies, medical and dental offices, and realty. This is very similar with Cedar Hills. We don't have access to a booming area. You have to drive to a job site typically. You either work at home or you drive somewhere. As Alpine does not currently receive public transportation services, similar to Cedar Hills, other than paratransit services, any individual who does not have their own transportation would not have any public transportation options available in order to travel to and from their employment in other cities. So these are similar challenges, and this is where I wanted to highlight what Alpine has done. But Alpine, they go on to say, nonetheless, to ensure that moderate income housing exists, Alpine should continue to allow accessory apartments. And one thing I think they've even gone farther than us, and I think this is something the city could consider, is the city also has no minimum requirement on house size, which may provide you a manner in which housing prices can be made more affordable. That is something to consider.
So you have to have a half acre lot where you can put a tiny home on.
Yes.
But
right now we have housing size requirements in each zone.
But the market dictates that you're going to put a house that's big enough that somebody's going to want to buy it. So whether there's a limit or not, nobody's building tiny houses.
I've had people inquire about it.
They're building tiny homes on tiny lots, though. They don't have half acre lots if they're putting a 450 square foot.
No, you're right. People want a tiny home because they don't want...
You don't want the big lot. That's
don't
the
want the big lot. You want...
Buy a town home.
If you look at what Provo's done, Provo's in South Provo, south of Center Street, they've got that, I don't know what they call it, their economic blah, blah, blah zone. You've seen what they're allowing now.
Yeah.
I mean, you can put an eight-story building.
I need to go and see this.
They're not building them necessarily, but they're allowing down by the train station there, there's these lots around where they're encouraging
very, very self.
Yeah. They're encouraging 7 to 8 story buildings. I have a friend. These 7 to 8 story buildings, they want literally 400 unit developments to go in, and the lots they're allowing to have 20% land space. 20-25%
less. Well, see,
it's a parking lot and eight-story building.
You have to have space for that.
Oh, no. Yeah. I'm just saying, Provo's got an answer because they got this region that is...
Yeah, so you have
and they've got transit-oriented development.
And it's totally transit-oriented. So it's extremely different from our situation.
Right. And so I think that when we're drafting this, there's portions of the plan that we're going to flesh out a little bit more. And maybe describe what exactly our challenges are. So when we submit to the state, I want them to have a clear understanding of, look, I know we're right by Pleasant Grove, we're right by American Fork, we're really close to Vineyard, they have a ton of housing.
Oh, yeah, Vineyard's got.
But our situation is night and day different. You know, and if you don't believe me, let's go for a drive.
Yeah. Can we adopt a sister city and just have them do it for us?
That was the sarcasm.
It's more dense.
So then Highland actually.
That's what they're actually doing by imposing this tax. They're saying if you don't do it, we're going to take money from you and put it in other areas. And we're kind of merging the whole state and trying to equalize.
And there are some people.
And we're trying to avoid that by saying we're trying to do our part.
There are some people who would rather do that than address this.
Okay. So then I'll just play devil's advocate. I think it's my turn. If that's the case, I mean, last year the state came in and said, we're going to cut off 1% of your sales tax, and we're going to take it from the state. We're not going to give it to you. We're not going to charge you for it. We're just not going to give it to you. And we're going to redirect it to these communities that have these homeless shelters. Right? That's fine, but that sets a precedent right there that the state can go in there and start toying with the sales tax distribution formula, which a city like us, we rely heavily on the way that formula is laid out right now, because half of it is point of sale, and half of it is just based on you being you, having a population, money getting redirected to you. But now that they've set that precedent, there's nothing stopping the state from coming in this year saying, well, 1% wasn't enough, we're going to take another 2%, so that's 3%. All of a sudden, we're looking at $60,000 that then goes out. Well, the impact on you, you can say, okay, well then we don't get that $60,000. From a city's perspective, we're looking at that saying, what service gets cut? What $60,000 are we not going to, what $60,000 in services are not being provided to residents anymore? And if you still want those residents, where's that money coming from? It's gonna have to be property taxes. So you're still buying stuff and getting taxed, and that money's getting redirected to the state. And if we're not getting that money, and we have to still provide that service, then it's almost like it being double taxed. It presents some real financial challenges for the city. And so if the state comes in and has even just punitive measures for cities that aren't doing their part, or even aren't even trying to do their part, it could be even more problematic. One of the big fears I have is that as you see legislature try to battle with cities and in terms of local control, meaning right now we're the masters of our dominion here. We get to choose what we want our city to look like. Well, if developers lobby, I'm going to be very frank right now, but if enough developers go to the state legislature and get them to say, look, cities aren't being accommodated. Cities aren't doing their share. Cities aren't letting us do this through our part. Our fees are so high because of what cities are doing, all of a sudden we're the bad guys. Cities are the bad guys. And they come in and say, okay, well now we're going to start making land use decisions for you.
Are you talking about improving density?
Yes. Yes.
We won't let you have the density that you want.
There could be changes, and I think this is long term. I don't think this is going to happen this year. But a fear of mine is that they could come in and say, well, since you're not going to make the right decision to help our wider community, we're going to make that decision for you. And let's say that we have to build Harvey Park and we have 12 acres there, and they say, look, you've got 12 acres right there that we're going to make you put modern to low-income housing. You've got that available right there. It's kind of a nightmare scenario, but we're not the only city that have looked at this and said we're concerned.
But it's not that far-fetched either.
It's not.
I mean, we had a perfect case example over the last 2 years. Just anyway.
And we had an example where we had to put really high density development.
And that's not even really high.
Not as high as we wanted.
No, right, but
I mean, it's the highest in the community, but it's high to us. But if you go to Vineyard, it's like wide open spaces.
Yeah, but I mean, but the threat was, you know, you put too many limitations on it, so we're going to make you do this.
Yes, you know, and so the more cases the state sees of cities acting irresponsibly, and I don't believe we acted irresponsibly there. I think the outcome is actually better than what was being proposed. It presents some real challenges for cities when they say, we're doing our part, and then the development community says, look what we're doing. You know, I feel like Cedar Hills has done a good job in trying to address the situation, but there are communities that are not trying to address the situation, that are taking more of the mentality of the poor finals to pay the tax. So if that's the community that you want, well, we have to figure out.
Yeah. So what ratios are they actually looking for?
In terms of what? Well, they're saying right now that we need to have, according to this report,
we are at about 10%.
Well, here's another problem. Here's another problem. This will be the last problem I bring up tonight. It's getting late. Is on the page that has a 20 in a box with it. Is this what it looks like? This?
Yeah.
They're saying 20 additional moderate income dwellings by 2023. Now, one of the challenges I need the state to understand is that our growth is not linear. Like, we had a boom through 2000 to 2007, and then it dropped off a cliff, and it's growing a lot. But I mean, you can see, let's say Cedar Canyon, we got all developed next year, and you saw 80 building permits, and they said, oh my gosh, we have that. Let's extrapolate that into the future. Well, it just doesn't make sense because we know that there's not going to be land like that. So my concern is that we have to really clearly address to the state that our growth is not linear and that this number is going to dwindle over time. That there's going to be a point when it's just, we don't have any.
And then they're going to say, redevelop.
It could get to that point where you have other portions of the community that then do go into some sort of CDA.
How does the new proposed development south of Walmart factor into this?
The Cedar Canyon?
Is that the con? The 80 lot subdivision?
Whatever it's called.
Right. It's Cedar Canyon. It won't. It won't. It will have zero affordable housing.
None of them are going to be built under that.
I would think they're probably going to be double that at least.
You're going to be actions.
Yes.
I'll tell you, my home is not priced that high. And my lot is almost twice as big as any lot in there. Okay.
We're down the street.
Wow. Okay.
So that's what they're hoping for, I think.
High-end small houses.
What?
High-end houses.
They're supposed to be high-end houses. Smaller craftsman-style high-end houses. Smaller so lots.
We're not picking up any on that. Tiny lots.
They're tiny lots. But like I said, density does not necessarily equate to affordability.
Maybe the state of Panama developers a little bit.
It's hard on the state because they're developing.
Well, they're playing both sides.
Imagine that.
So my request to you is, in the next, as we leave here tonight, I think I've laid the table for you as far as the challenges with moderate income housing. Be thinking about housing goals. Look at objectives. Look at policies. I would encourage you to go look at other cities' general plans, and you'll find inside of them an affordable housing unit plan. See what their objectives, see what their policies are, and kind of ask yourself, does that make sense here? Because we've got to come up with it.
You could have an accessory apartment approved even if it wasn't being leased, right?
Say
a unit is affordable and available only if that unit is both affordable and vacant or is currently occupied by a household at or below the defined income threshold.
So could
we would count that
it has to be there either vacant or have somebody living in it that is below the threshold.
No, what I'm saying is you encourage people to apply even if they have no present intention of leasing.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Huh. It's vacant, but it's
yes. You couldn't be nice in the way I feel like the way that we've set up the ADU process. It would encourage that, whereas before it would totally discourage it. You couldn't get them to have them occupied.
So maybe you should go a little further. Do some kind of incentive. I don't know what that incentive would look like. It's probably not monetary, but.
Buy an early sandwich.
Free doll.
Free doll. No, and those are the kind of things. I mean, we've talked about incentives on other things. We've just had high-level discussions, but like if you're going to zero-skip half your yard, we charge you less on the base rate for PI usage, things like that. Because you want to encourage the type of governments encourage behavior one way or another, whether it's taxes, whether it's fees, whether it's penalties, one way or another, we encourage certain types of behavior. And you're right, incentives matter. What they are, I don't know. And this is where I'd say maybe go look at some other communities, see what they're doing, and ask yourself, does that make sense for Cedar Hills?
Yeah, you look at Orem and you compare to us.
You need to look at communities that are probably similar in nature to us, ones that have similar challenges.
Or even some neighborhoods, potentially.
Yeah, I mean, there's got to be a lot of basement apartments for people.
I mean, like Far East Provo, like they've got similar situations to what we have all of their houses.
If I were to guess on the number of apartments in the city, I'd put it at about 250, which is well over what we need.
I don't want to say, maybe Chandler would say, our city's also aging rapidly. In my LDS ward, we had like 100 kids in the primary like 5-6 years ago. Now we're down to 40, and there's like one Sunday. I mean, it's like inwardly imploding. And we have all these 5-6 bedroom houses in my ward, and like people move out. I'm like, oh, I get a family in there. And they're all older couples. It's amazing. And it's like their second home. They like having their temple. They have some retired relatives, and they go on missions, and they all have a second house in California. I'm like, wow, this is brilliant. And so I think there will be a lot of people who can rent out basement apartments. going forward, unless we see a huge demographic explosion. You have tons of houses, great for young families, and no young family can afford these awesome houses, but and older people love them.
Same thing in my world, that's why I was kind of thinking about that, Joel.
Same principle.
I mean, it is what it is.
Ours is aging out, too. Ours
but,
is
it's aging out, but think about, honestly, it's your kids that are going to be looking for housing. They want to stay locally.
Yeah.
They're going to be looking at ADUs. They're not going to be looking at purchasing a home or a mortgage.
That's my kids.
I mean, I'm kind of at the tail end of the generation that's purchasing homes out here. Now, the ones I see, my littler brothers, who are looking at apartments, not homes anymore. They're looking at townhomes and condos, not homes. There's a big shift away from quarter, third acre, single family dwelling. It's just the reality of it. So a lot, I think there's kind of this premonition that this housing crisis is completely caused by people moving in from out of state. And I think the numbers I heard on that was that's about 40% of the problem. 60% of the problem is people here want to stay here.
Most of the growth is coming from internal. There are people moving in, but like
it's mostly internal.
Our population grows better than others.
although to be fair, that is slowing versus 20 or 30 years.
True, but we're still we're still at four kids rather than the two kids with the rest of the country.
Still
ahead
of the national
average.
Way ahead of the national
average. And my friend is really messing with that curve. He's on number 8 now.
I'm not in a position to speak.
Any questions? If you have any questions in the meantime, in the run-up to the next meeting, because let me tell you this, I would like to have this approved at the next meeting. Reason being, if we're going into another legislative session in January, and I really, really don't want to be the community that doesn't have a moderate income housing plan that developers are saying. Some of you don't even have a plan for this problem.
Oh, you don't want to get called out in session?
Probably not.
Okay.
So I would like to have something approved in November, and I'd like to have something on the docket for the council in December. And then if we aren't, like I said, if we're not comfortable with it, we can then go in and revise it. We can go in there and play it, but we at least have something on the books.
Are we allowed to have you send drafts of what you're looking at to us?
Yeah, we're going to be communicating that with the state. Yes. What I don't know if they'll give us a clean thumbs up or thumbs down, but I at least wanted to have eyes on it and get the feedback.
What I'm saying, if you can send it to us as a commission,
you want
drafts 2 weeks before
this is it.
I will send a Word perfect document. I said because we still have Word files on our server, but a Word document of this so you can go in and edit it to your heart's content.
This is the first draft.
This is the first draft.
Got it.
Yeah. Please.
So we're going to town. We're all good to go to town and send you copying everybody, and that's not violating any rules for us to do that?
No. Okay.
Not at all. Just keep in mind, all of those emails are grandma requestable.
Yes.
So. So, mind your P's and Q's.
If you feel like you want to add, I would deliberate a lot. I would probably just say, here's my thoughts, write it out, send it to the group. Please make sure that I'm on it. I don't mean that because I want to know the business.
No.
I want that email to be captured by the city server so that when my emails are grandma requested, somebody can say, oh, here's the emails that the planning commission sent.
So we're back up and running on the IT side now?
What?
Oh, yeah.
We're spending on security now. Site back.
We have to take a test every week on how we're doing with cybersecurity.
Yeah,
which is annoying, but less annoying.
It's been helpful.
Crashing the server. Yeah. Okay. Because it's a big enough document. There's enough here that in our next meeting, I don't want to have to take 2 hours to go over it.
No, I think the next meeting I won't have to lay the groundwork for what affordable housing is. I think most of the commissioners are fairly familiar with it at this point. I'll encourage the ones that weren't here to listen to the audio.
Yes.
There's Jenny pointed out a couple of links to some state websites that kind of give some good input. We'll send those out to you. There's enough material out there that if you want to read about this till next month, you won't be finished.
Trying to be expeditious about it for everybody involved.
We really need to pass something. And this is really good start.
I worked in the space for about 8 years and didn't learn even a fraction.
We're not going to learn all that we need to know to be experts at it in order to get something through that shows that we're making strides.
Yes, try. And I think the city needs to perform a good faith effort.
And if Lieutenant Governor Cox gets elected to become the governor, he is very passionate about this stuff, and things will change even more.
This isn't going away.
No, it's not. But he's very, very excited about this.
I have to ask, and I know I'm going on record with this, but there are about 10 or 15% of the communities in the state that are unduly burdened by this. Is it just because it's only 15% of the communities and 5% of the populace that they're very comfortable just running roughshod over them? They don't care about Park City, they don't care about Alpine City.
No, they care.
Oh, Park City has some really intense affordable housing efforts. They've got a couple of developers that do only affordable and workforce housing. They've got temporary housing for like seasonal workers. They've got nonprofits who fund this stuff. It's a big deal.
Yeah, they make great strides. It's, our challenge is different than Park City, obviously. I think the demographics are
dramatically different.
Same in some ways, different in others, but. I think our biggest issue is more in terms of land availability than the demographic itself. I mean, unless you're going to go through the RDA process and knock down a neighborhood and say,
if we had a giant building on where the Cedar Canyon is going in, would that have made a difference here?
That would cause more problems than it was.
So I'll argue that.
But the way that they were originally proposing it, I don't believe that would account either.
Because it's still too expensive?
Initially, I think that the price would have come down similar to other buildings that have been built of that nature. I'm trying to coin it and answer your question at the same time.
Do you like Europe and Asia and go through the parts of a dollar store and one of the pieces and
you can do that, but the problem with that is you still need transit. I mean, Highland tried that out by there, because that's a good point. And that's one of the, if you go through the list, that's one of the things they encourage cities to do. But Highland tried that out by their city building, their city center, and it didn't work.
Two times a day bus service doesn't cut it.
Yeah,
we get that much bus service.
There's two. So it's an hour between it leaving, and then when it comes back, it's an hour between, and that's it. Like if you miss the bus, you have to call your wife and make her come get you, and it's really bad to get to things on point. Not that I've experienced that.
Thank you.
I move that we adjourn until next time.
Who seconded it? I didn't get Jared. Okay, thank you.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?